Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we celebrate hedgerows. They provide food, shelter, corridors of movement and nest and hibernation sites for much of our native flora and fauna. We speak to the researcher leading a team investigating the genetics of zebrafish in an effort to improve the lives of those affected by scar tissue. And it's time to get out your binoculars and books as we encourage you to take part in Birdwatch Ireland's annual Garden Bird Survey.
We live in Ballinteer in South Dublin. We're just at the foothills of the Dublin Mountains and we live in an old house from 1939. So we're really lucky to have a nice long rectangular garden. We have plenty of space in our garden. And I have two kids, Jamie, who's 11, and Holly, who is 9. We have never taken part in the Irish Garden Bird Survey before. So actually, they were really excited when I told them that this is something we're going to be doing for the next 13 weeks.
Oh, the wonderful sound of the robin outside my back door this morning in my rear garden. We'll talk about the Garden Bird Survey in just a moment, but let's begin by talking to our panel today. And we start in Malahide in North County Dublin with Dr. Richard Collins. Richard, are you having a good day?
Yes, Derek, it has been a magical day. Every morning, Barbara and I go up Paddy's Hill in Robswall Park, and it's different every day, but this morning's was especially magical. There was a white frost and this strange pale mist low down over everything, the lambed protruding up to it. It was quite magical, I must say.
Sounds delicious. And Niall Hatch is in Kilcool in County Wicklow. Did you go any walks over the weekend, Niall?
I did, absolutely. I had some treats as well. We've had a big fall of a lovely bird called a siskin here on the North Wicklow coast. So on my 5K walk limit, I can easily see those. It's absolutely lovely. But I had a really special treat this morning, a bird called a yellow-browed warbler, which was actually found by my Birdwatch Ireland colleague, Dick Coombs, who lives nearby as well. This is a tiny little warbler, barely bigger than a goldcrest, which is Ireland's smallest bird. But it migrates here all the way from Asia, from Siberia, perhaps even as far away as eastern China. Eastern Russia as well. And it seems like more and more of these birds are migrating to Ireland now in the autumn time. So that was a real treat to see. It's a real sort of
that's within your 5K limit. It's not within Richard's 5K limit. I bet he's mad jealous. Richard?
It's terrible I'm imprisoned here, but there's so much where I live. I mean, I don't have to worry in the slightest. There's wonderful things on the estuary, wonderful sights, astronomical sights as well at this time of year. It's very interesting.
It is indeed. Anyway, it's that time of year again when our friends at Birdwatch Ireland ask you, our listeners and their members, and indeed the general public, to keep an eye on the birds that are visiting their gardens and collate all the information that they have gathered over a period of time and then submit it to Birdwatch Ireland so they can get a kind of snapshot of this time and this place and this area and what kind of birds were there or not there. Niall Hatch can explain more. Niall.
I can. It's one of my favourite things of all, so I'm delighted to. It's our annual Irish Garden Bird Survey, and it's starting this week, and it runs for 13 weeks up until the end of February. And during the survey, what we do is we ask people all over Ireland to keep note of the different species of birds that are coming into their gardens and the highest number of each of those species that they see at any one time that week, and then do that over 13 weeks and send the data back into us. I know it sounds a little bit complicated, but actually it's fairly straightforward once you get the hang of it, and it's really, really good fun, very enjoyable thing to do. But most importantly of all, the data that we get back from that really helps to inform our conservation work. It's Ireland's largest and most active and longest running citizen science project. So we have lots of people doing this, basically citizen scientists contributing their data. So it's an opportunity for everybody listening to Mooney Goes Wild to be a scientist and to contribute to conservation.
Now you say it is the longest running. So how long? How many years?
We've been going for over 30 years now with this survey. So it goes back before citizen science was even a concept. So that's something we're very, very proud of. And over those three decades, we have built up a great database of bird movements and bird patterns and population levels across the country. So we're able to see real changes at a population level, see how birds are responding to things like climate change, food availability, weather patterns, and so on. Sometimes people think that a conservation organization like Birdwatch Ireland, that we'd only be concerned with the rare birds and the rare creatures, but nothing could be further from the truth. The rare ones are very important and we conserve those. We can actually tell a lot though from the common birds and the changes in their populations, because there's a lot more of them, there's a lot more people are familiar with them and more pairs of eyes looking out for them. So they actually reflect the changes in the environment sometimes a lot better than monitoring the rare birds do. So it's a really important piece of work.
Now, how many bird species do we have on the list registered in Ireland? And just explain what that list is for the benefit, again, of our listeners, please, Niall.
So there is an official Irish list of all of the birds that have been reliably and verifiably recorded in Ireland. That's maintained by a body called the Irish Rare Birds Committee. And because of Ireland's location, we really punch above our weight when it comes to the number of birds on the list. So we, of course, have our core breeding species and our wintering species and our migrant species that come here regularly. We also get lots of accidental visitors who come across, maybe across from North America, get caught up in hurricane systems, or birds maybe from Siberia, which have migrated the wrong direction, perhaps due to a genetic abnormality. So there's just over 460 birds officially recorded in Ireland, which is a very high number. It actually would be the envy of many landlocked European countries that are bigger than us, for example. So being on the sea really pays off. So 460, but of those, you would expect maybe in a good year, you could reliably see 150, 160 species, maybe even up to 200 if you really put some effort in.
And how many of those would be considered garden birds?
Well, it all depends on what you consider a garden, because gardens come in many different shapes and sizes. So some people who take part in our survey have mini nature reserves in their gardens with reed-fringed ponds, and they're getting all sorts of water birds in. But I would say there's a core maybe of about 35 to 40 species, which we could reasonably expect to turn up in a typical garden. Some of them require a bit of luck, but that's sort of the ballpark we're talking about.
And from the surveys you've carried out over the years, what is the most common bird?
Well, for the last 10 years in a row, it has been the robin, everybody's favourite. It's not necessarily the most common in terms of the sheer numbers, because most gardens would only have one robin during the winter. We get other birds coming in large flocks. But it's the one that's present in the most gardens in the surveys. Well over 99% of gardens have a robin in them in the survey. And then just behind that is the blackbird, another very common garden bird. And just behind that again then is the blue tit. And they're almost always in the top three. It's usually robin, blackbird and blue tit.
Now, they're birds that are relatively easy to identify, let's be honest about it. So you're looking for people all over the country to take part in this survey. We'll find out the details about how they can do that very shortly. But we have a friend of Mooney Goes Wild, Jenny Brannigan, who has agreed to take part in your garden bird survey for the first time. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, Niall. Hello, Derek. How are you both?
We're very good. So, Jenny, if you could begin by giving us a pen picture of your family, where you live and the type of garden you have, please.
No problem. So we live in Ballinteer in South Dublin. We're just at the foothills of the Dublin Mountains and we live in an old house from 1939. So we're really lucky to have a nice long rectangular garden. We have plenty of space in our garden. And I have two kids, Jamie, who's 11, and Holly, who is 9. And they are mad about birds. So they already have me going up to Marley Park to look at the peacocks. We're always on the lookout for the grey heron at the end of Dunleary Pier. My dad has pigeons in his garden, so they always look at the baby birds when they, you know, when eggs are laid and when they're hatching. And they particularly love that when they were kids going out to the loft. So we have never taken part in the Irish Garden Bird Survey before. So actually, they were really excited when I told them that this is something we're going to be doing for the next 13 weeks.
It's fantastic. Does your dad keep pigeons? Is he a pigeon fancier?
He is absolutely a pigeon fancier. He grew up in Collins Barracks and he used to chase the pigeons by climbing up on all those buildings there. I can't even imagine it. So he has always had a pigeon loft, and all throughout my childhood, we had pigeons out in the back garden and he'd be showing us the baby pigeons. They'd be resting up on top of our roof and flying around. And then my brother, he actually set up a business when he was in college where he used to release white pigeons or rock doves. And even still now on my kids' birthdays, my dad comes over with white pigeons and he releases the number of pigeons corresponding to the birthday that my child is having. So pigeons are very much a part of my life.
Now, Niall, do those birds count?
Well, in the sense that feral pigeons count, yes, if they come into your garden. Basically, any bird that you record that is actually actively using your garden. So if it's a bird like a blackbird hopping on the lawn trying to find worms, that's obviously using your garden. A blue tit maybe going to the peanut feeder, or a robin feeding in a tree, that's using it. A bird like a gull, for example, just flying overhead by chance, that doesn't count. But if it's a bird like a bird of prey, like a kestrel or a sparrowhawk that is flying over your garden looking for prey, that is actively using your garden. So certainly if pigeons of any kind turn up in the garden, that certainly counts, absolutely.
Now, how many birds do you think you could identify? Remember, Niall said there's something like 460 on the Irish list. Jenny, how far could you go?
Well, I am no bird expert. I certainly can recognise magpies. Actually, I thought it was interesting you were saying that robins, then blackbirds, then blue tits are the three most commonly seen. In our garden, we get loads of magpies. So I can certainly identify them. I can definitely identify a pigeon because, as I say, I've grown up with them. I guess we love robins as well. My mother-in-law likes robins, and she talks actually in December about the fact that the robins like to keep an eye on the kids, and the robins report back to the North Pole. So my kids have a healthy respect for the robin. What else can I recognise? We're probably getting to the limit now. Certainly I would know a crow if I saw it, and I would know a blackbird. But you might find that might be the limit of my expertise. So is that enough?
Oh, Jenny, that's certainly enough, because you'll find that as you go on, you'll start to use those species that you know to compare against the ones that you don't know. And it's a great way to build up knowledge. I find that when you actually have a purpose, like a task to complete, such as this survey, it focuses the mind in a very particular way. And it's a great way to learn more about birds. So what we do is we ask people to just note down the birds that they can identify and to give the counts as accurately as possible. And if there's birds you can't identify, well, it's a great way to learn about them is to compare them to the birds you do know. Is it bigger, smaller, darker, lighter, all of these different things. And then on BirdWatch Ireland's website, birdwatchireland.ie, we have an online guide to Ireland's garden birds, where you can find pictures and information about all of these birds. So it's a learning process. And of course, if people are wondering what they're seeing, if they can send photographs or even just descriptions to us in BirdWatch Ireland, we'll be happy to help and assist. And before you know it, you'll be an expert. And hopefully then raring to go again next year with all the newfound knowledge.
Excellent. Well, I think my kids will certainly know a lot more about it than I will initially, and they'll be able to teach me a lot about it. My daughter's in third class, and when I mentioned this to her, she said that they'd already been talking about it in school, and the teacher had shown them the website. So that's pretty great.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, there's lots of schools doing this now, and it's a really wonderful school project. And it's great that you're doing it with your children too, because it's a wonderful family activity. And at a time, you know, when so many of us are stuck indoors, spending a lot more time at home than we normally would, what better way to unwind and relax and forget about our worries than to try and watch the birds in the garden? I always get so much pleasure from them, all the antics they get up to, the beautiful plumages. But then, of course, we're all contributing to science and conservation in a meaningful way too. So it's a really great situation.
I love the notion of the Citizen Science Project. And again, I think that's a great thing to be promoting, that idea among children, because again, they'll get a great sense of pride in finding the birds that are in their garden on a particular day and reporting. So I really like that process. And again, the positivity that's associated with that you're a citizen scientist. I think that's great.
How often does Jenny have to feed back her information to you, Niall?
So the information, we just need it back at the end of the survey. So there's two ways that people can take part. One is by using a paper form, which is available on our website as a PDF. You can download that, print it off and have it on your kitchen table or by your windowsill, noting down the birds you see, adding up the columns for each week, and then at the end of February, sending it back to us. Or you can keep a running total by going to the website, birdwatchireland.ie, and inputting the data there directly too. So you can input it on our website as you go, or you can just send in the paper form at the end. The main thing is we need to have all the data in hopefully by March, so that we can then start tabulating it, working out all the different statistics, and then coming up with a picture for this winter. So we always get very excited when we do that, because there's new things we're finding every year. It's fascinating stuff.
Does she count the same bird twice in the same day, Niall, can I just ask?
So it's only the birds that you see at any one time. So you're not keeping a running total. So if you looked out the window and let's say there were two blue tits on the peanut feeder and one robin in the tree, you look out later and there are three blue tits on the feeder but no robin in the tree. Well, your total for that day, it would be the maximum you saw at one time was the three blue tits and the one robin. So that's the way you do it. So it's not a cumulative total. It's just the amount that you're seeing at any one time.
At any one time. Okay, Jenny, you got that. You understand it anyway and you've had a look at the website. Is your husband going to participate in this project, Jenny?
Absolutely. He had a look out of the curtains this morning and he was pointing out the birds that I needed to get out of bed to have a look at. So they're all extremely enthusiastic.
You're all going to become curtain twitchers. Jenny, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you very soon. Thank you, Jenny. Bye.
Thanks, Derek.
There goes
Thanks,
Jenny
Niall.
Brannigan and her family, and they're going to take part in the Garden Bird Survey on behalf of the Mooney Goes Wild programme. But Richard, you've got grandchildren and you have kids. They're not kids anymore. Did you ever take part in it? Do you still do it?
Well, in my case, it's a little invalid because I have a mist net which I open whenever I see birds around the garden. And it kind of alters everything, you see, because it interferes with the system. But there was a very interesting paper published last month in the University of Montana by a fellow called Christopher Hansen. And he is investigating what they call the urban wildlife paradox. And the urban wildlife paradox, if you take, for instance, human civilization, over the last few centuries, half the world's population have moved into cities. The interesting thing is that the wildlife is doing the same. You're getting a mass movement into gardens, and the garden has become extremely important, an extremely important habitat, a crucial habitat for biodiversity. Now, he investigated the numbers of birds and mammals in gardens, 58 of the gardens, and compared them with woodland, which should be their natural habitat. Now, he set up cameras in 58 gardens and recorded everything that went on. And he found that the greater biodiversity was in the artificial garden situation. Now, there was a mention there of water features and ponds and things. So he looked at the features of the gardens that he had, where they had chicken coops, vegetable patches, water features, so-called, little ponds and fountains and things, and whether there were feeding stations or brush piles or whatever. And he found that actually the water features didn't matter very much. Brush piles are little, for the mafiosi of the wildlife world, the rats and the mice, the ones that nobody likes, they live in things like brushes. But he found that water features didn't count, but the crucial thing was the handouts of food. That was the real attraction of gardens. There was some attraction for safety and security as well, he found. For instance, birds moving into the city or into the suburbs feel they are less vulnerable to predators. Hawks and falcons and things don't get them there so easily, or so he seemed to argue, which raises an interesting thing about the Garden Bird Survey in Ireland. It would be interesting to ask everyone participating in the survey whether or not they have a cat. That would be an interesting finding. But this survey is capable of extraordinary expansion and yielding the most extraordinary results over the years.
Yes, Richard, you're absolutely right. And we're seeing that expansion happening as part of the survey itself over the years. You know, the table is changing all the time. And you might not notice it when you're looking in your garden year on year, but when you look at back over the past 30 years, you really do see some patterns. So one that's very interesting to me is that when we first started the survey, goldfinches were only present in 4% of the gardens that took part. Now it's always around between 83 and 86% of the gardens in the survey. Now, obviously, the people who take part in the survey tend to be fairly well up on their garden birds. They're feeding the birds, at least they get to know them, and this is attracting the birds in. But that has always been the case right from the very start. So there does seem to have been a really real expansion of goldfinches, particularly into gardens. We're also seeing it over the last decade or so. We're seeing it with the jay as well. It's still a very scarce visitor to most gardens in Ireland, or doesn't most gardens indeed don't see it, but the percentage is creeping up each year. So the jay is a member of the crow family, but it doesn't really look like a crow. It's a sort of pinkish bird with metallic blue flashes in the wing, a really, really gorgeous looking creature. Very secretive though, tends usually to stay in oak woodlands, but now more and more are coming to garden bird feeders. It's still nowhere near cracking the top 20 in the survey, but it is creeping up. And also, we're seeing great spotted woodpeckers turning up in more gardens now. They've been recorded in no fewer than 11 counties. This is a species that only colonised Ireland roughly about 15 years ago. A population seems to have come across from Wales into Wicklow, and another population from Scotland into County Down. And they they've slowly but surely been expanding from there and are turning up on peanut feeders. And if we weren't doing this survey, we wouldn't be able to track the actual spread and the increase in the percentage of gardens. So it's really interesting stuff.
Those present and those absent are very interesting. And I agree, the goldfinch is an arrival. I remember 20, 30 years ago, I hadn't ringed hardly any goldfinches. Now it's quite a common bird in the garden. But the one I miss most is the tree sparrow, the little brown-crowned fellow. He used to come here, but he is totally gone. I haven't seen one, let alone caught one, in years and years. And the other one that's gone is the yellowhammer. He would occasionally venture into the garden. So what is the picture nationwide on those two?
But the situation in your garden has been reflected nationwide. Both the tree sparrow and the yellowhammer are going down and down as garden visitors. They are still in some pockets, particularly East Leinster, you still do get them. Kildare, County Meath, parts of North Dublin are still quite good for both species, but they are declining. And I think the reason for that is changes in farming. Those are species that rely very much on tillage farming and particularly on winter stubble. And those are disappearing from many parts of Ireland, and those birds are disappearing with them. If you go to places like Poland, for example, you'll see vast mixed flocks of tree sparrows and yellowhammers, thousands of birds. And presumably that was a sight we once had in Ireland as well, but no more. And it's surveys like this that really bring that home and give the hard data that proves that is happening. One of the things people often say to me as well is they say, well, there's no point in me taking part in the survey. I don't get very many birds in my garden, or I have no birds at all. And of course, negative data is just as valuable as positive data. We need to know that for our survey as well. So if you don't have any birds in your garden, or you're getting very low totals, please do still take part in the survey and let us know. We need to map where that's happening and maybe try and come up with reasons why.
Okay, Niall, so remind people how they can participate, please.
So the easiest way to participate is just to go to the Birdwatch Ireland website. It's birdwatchireland.ie. There on the homepage, you'll see a very prominent link to the Irish Garden Bird Survey. Just click through to that. It gives you all sorts of information. There's even an instructional video, and it gives you details. You can download the form. You can put your totals in on the page itself. And of course, if anyone has any queries, you can get in touch with us through the Birdwatch Ireland website as well. We'd be delighted to help.
Thank you, Niall. And you can always visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney, if you didn't catch what Niall said there. There you will find a full and accurate record of all of the programmes that we broadcast each week on RTE Radio 1. So a chance to find further reading also, and to listen back to some of the programmes you may have missed. Now, you're hearing the Dawn Chorus in the background. This was recorded at the East Coast Nature Reserve in Kilcool this year for this year's broadcast of the Dawn Chorus. Not a sound to be heard. It was perfect. The weather was beautiful. When I say not a sound, obviously the birds were singing, but nothing else because we were in full lockdown. But usually we broadcast from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove in County Cork with our friend Jim Wilson. And that is the reason I'm playing it today. Not because of Jim, but because of the people who own the land there. I received an email during the week which says, "Dear Derek and team, it would be great this dark time of the year if you and the team could send a message of thanks to my wonderful cousins David, Heather and Andrew Bird for helping you to bring joy to the world from Kuskany Marsh. Sadly, the elms on the roadway are dying back. I have great childhood memories of the joy of riding along that avenue on top of a haycock." He goes on to say, "Please give my regards to Anna." I will indeed. "I first met her when she was librarian of the much lamented Forest Forbaha." She was indeed. "Thanks to the whole team for keeping up such a bright, informative and accessible show. John Bird." Well, thank you very much indeed, John. And hello to David and to Heather and to Andrew. And regards to Anna Neelan. So a little bit more of the Dawn Chorus before we move on. Now, if that doesn't bring joy to the world, I don't know what will. Did you see an article that appeared in the newspapers last week, and it was all about scarring? A £1.5 million sterling research programme to improve the lives of those affected by scarring is being led by the University of Bristol. Researchers will study the genetics of zebrafish. Yeah, zebrafish, which can regrow tissues and repair wounds rapidly. To tell us more about this interesting project, we're joined from the University of Bristol by Dr. Rebecca Richardson. Hello, Rebecca. I believe you like to be called Beck.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell us about this project, please, if you would.
We are really excited to get started with this project funded by the Scar Free Foundation. So we are going to be investigating really the genetic control of scarring. So if you have changes to certain genes, how that affects the severity of a scar that you might have. And this is a way for us to determine the genes that are really important in controlling level of scarring, so in the biology of scarring then. So we need to understand precisely how a scar is formed and the proteins then that are very important for that happening. So the way we will do this initially is to look at very large numbers of patients, of human patients, who've had the same kind of procedure done to them. So this could be people who've had a cleft lip repaired, or women who've had a cesarean section. So my colleagues in Bristol have already done a pilot study where they're actually measuring the BCG scar that you would get from a BCG vaccination. And by measuring these very similar scars, because these procedures are done in a very similar way, we can measure those then across thousands of different people. And we can look at the people who have scars that might be larger, more severe, or ideally people who have very small scars resulting from those procedures. And then we also have a chance, working with colleagues in population health sciences, to look at the DNA of those. So we can also then look for changes in specific genes that are associated with having that larger scar or ideally having a smaller scar. So this gives us an idea of the genes that we should be looking at in controlling scarring. And then we can go on to study those genes in the zebrafish model, which is what my lab is working on in biomedical sciences building.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, why zebrafish?
Yeah, so the zebrafish have been studied now in medical research for over 40 years. And there's lots of reasons why they're really amazing model for us to be studying. So they share a lot of the same genes that we have. So they have around 70% equivalent genes to us. So we can study the function of genes very well, even related to human disease. The main reason people started studying them is that they lay eggs externally. So we can see very early development just by looking down a microscope. So you can just see those very first cell divisions. We can see all of their organs forming. They're completely transparent and they have formed most of their organs by 24 hours old. So they develop very rapidly. So we get a really amazing window of being able to observe these things as they're happening, all of these cells moving around, forming that vertebrate model. And we can do that just by looking down a microscope. We can see those things happening. And the other reason that we're interested in using the zebrafish is they're very regenerative. So they can regenerate lots of different tissues. So if they have any kind of injury, they can just completely regenerate that tissue to back to how it was before the injury. So for example, if they have a small injury to their tail, they can grow that back within 10 days. And we're not just talking skin, we're talking bone, we're talking blood vessels, we're talking nerves, you know, they can regenerate all of these different cell types. So that's really an incredible ability that we want to understand how they're able to do that. And in particular for this project, one of the amazing abilities the fish have is that they make a scar, they lay down scar tissue very similar to us, but over time, they will naturally remove that scar tissue. And so we want to understand exactly how they're able to do that.
How do you know that? I mean, has somebody witnessed a zebrafish with a scar and then over time that scar disappearing?
Yeah, I mean, it was really discovered. People have been looking at their regeneration for over 20 years now. I think really was noticed first with their fins. You know, if they're losing a small piece of their fin, then people discovered that they were able to grow this back. And then also we're looking at other tissues which are very relevant to medical research. So for example, they can regenerate their heart from damage that is similar to a heart attack. They can completely regenerate that tissue and go back to how it was beforehand. So yeah, it's really remarkable.
It's extraordinary. Now, we don't think of fish as having skin, but fish do have skin and they've got scales and they've got a kind of slimy mucus all over the surface of the body, do they not?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So the fish skin is different to ours. So we have an external barrier, which is waterproof. It's what, you know, keeps you nice and hydrated inside. If you get dry skin, you're seeing that dead outer surface of your skin, whereas in the fish, their skin consists solely of living cells. So they have cells that are alive. Those cells wrap around their scales. So the skin is on the outermost surface of the fish, the same as in us. And they have these very specialist mucus cells in their skin that produce the mucus, which is what gives them that kind of slimy feel if you pick them up.
Richard.
Beck, I get the impression that when it comes to scarring, that us mammals are the poor relations. We have the worst performance of the great classes among wild things. For instance, if you look at salamanders, it can grow back entire limbs if it loses them. And lizards go in for self-amputation. They grow back tails. And apparently they don't show any scars. Now, in us mammals, there's an African spring mouse that loses 60% of its skin in the same way and grows it back. But it is the exception. Would it not be better for you to look at him and similar other creatures like that that do this very well, rather than something as remote as a little fish?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the other advantages we have with the zebrafish is that their whole genome has been sequenced. So we know all of their genes and we can map the very similar genes that we are looking at, we might be interested in causing human diseases. We can find that gene precisely in the zebrafish. So if you're thinking about these species where perhaps their genome hasn't been sequenced, it's much harder to do those kind of studies. Of course, things like the mouse that you mentioned, they are very good models and they have advantages being mammals. They are more similar to humans than to fish in those instances. But there are, you know, ways that the fish can give us really interesting information that can be helpful for thinking about human disease or even studying those things later in a mammalian model. And the other advantage we have in the fish is that we are able to make lots of transgenic lines, so they will have fluorescent cells, so we can actually observe those cells as they are performing their normal function in a completely normal fish. And that's something that's very difficult to do in other models because, you know, they're not translucent, you can't see into them, you can't look at their skin precisely. So there are lots of advantages to doing these kind of studies in fish. But that's not to say that, you know, other studies in other animals are, of course, can give very important information as well.
How practical is this as a proposed therapy? For instance, you identify something in the genome, genes that govern scarring in a fish, and presumably you can infer similar processes in humans. But there's not a lot you can do about it genetically, is there? It's an epigenetic thing. Some injection goes in and triggers the gene to express itself or something like that. Can you possibly intervene in that and make people scar more aesthetically pleasing at the end of the day? Burn scars, for instance. A person burned extensively needs to have something done to improve their appearance.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that things like gene therapies are going to be very complex, very difficult. But I think one of the things that we are quite hopeful for is we know that, for example, the immune system is very important in scarring. It's important for driving scar deposition in the first place. What my lab is working on is that we also think that the inflammation is very important for that normal scar removal that we see in the fish. And the immune system, not necessarily thinking directly about individual genes, but the control that they might have of individual immune cell types, the immune system is quite druggable. You know, there are ways that we could perhaps promote certain types of immune cells or to reduce other types or to change their temporal localization. So, you know, when you're getting those cells being recruited or when you're telling them to go away from a wound. So we think that by combining that with potential treatments at the time that somebody is getting an injury, you know, the Scar-Free Foundation are funding lots of research into improved dressings and things like that, is that we might be able to have a combination of treatments that would ultimately reduce the amount of scarring that people would be experiencing.
Beck, surely if somebody's injured or burned or something like that, the substantive issue is recovery of the injury. And the scar is a sort of relatively minor thing. It's a side effect that, well, you can live with a scar. I have several scars. One I got when I was 3 and my face is still there to this day, 73 years on from that. Is there any suggestion that interfering with something so that the end product scarring will be minimal could delay or alter in any way the recovery process?
Yeah, I mean, certainly thinking about the immune system, we know, of course, you can't just stop the immune system from working, because especially when we're dealing with injuries in the skin, they're not sterile. So you absolutely have to have your immune system responding to that injury for the injury to repair normally. So yeah, it's a really good point. I think lots of us have scars that are, you know, relatively minor. You might have an interesting story behind them. But there are people that are very severely affected by scars. They can affect your mobility. You know, if you're getting them very early as a child, they're not going to change over time. So that means you have to have surgery to be releasing them. So they can be quite extreme and they can affect people long term. We, of course, have to balance that being able to repair the injury well and making sure that the tissue gets repaired. But long term, there is this need for reducing or facilitating better scarring in some way. So I think absolutely when you're thinking about repair, we have to think about the injury repair at the same time as thinking about the scarring. So we can't just block the immune system, for example, because that might reduce our scarring, but of course that's not going to work in an acute injury. So that's where, again, I think you're coming back to these combinations of therapies, you know, something specific at the time of injury, which is going to help the injury to repair as quickly as possible, but then perhaps treatments longer term that can hopefully diminish that scarring response.
Well, I say, Rebecca, bring it on, and sooner the better. I've got a few scars myself, nothing too embarrassing, but I do know people who have been badly affected by traumas throughout their lives and they have very bad scars on their bodies, and I'm sure they'll welcome any advances in this area. So thank you very much indeed, and we wish you the very best of luck with your research.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you indeed. That was Dr. Rebecca Richardson at the University of Bristol. We'll wait to see what happens. It's a 5-year project, so if we're still here, we'll be able to report on the findings. Now we're going to talk about hedgerows. They are truly multifunctional. For example, if I were to ask you which are the most bustling wildlife habitats in your immediate vicinity. Think about it now. Which are the most bustling wildlife habitats in your immediate vicinity? Well, the answer for many of us would be the humble hedgerow. They provide food, shelter, corridors of movement and nest and hibernation sites for many of our native flora and fauna. They also perform an important legal role. While many hedgerows along townland boundaries date from medieval times or earlier, most were planted during the 1700s and 1800s. Acts of Parliament were passed in 1697 and 1721, making it obligatory for landowners to erect proper permanent boundaries between their properties. They also regulate water movement and help prevent flooding, help stop the spread of airborne disease, provide shelter for livestock, and give character and a sense of place to the landscape. And so it is fitting that we celebrate this sometimes unsung hero of our countryside in the run-up to Chagask Hedgerow Week, starting Monday, 7th of December next. Éireann Ileana met Chagask Countryside Management Specialist Catherine Keena by a hedge on Pat Rooney's farm in Old Town in North County Dublin.
That's right, Derek. I'm here in North County Dublin. Now, this is a part of the world I'm not that familiar with. It's agricultural land. The fields are all full of crops. It's tillage farming. And, of course, all the fields are surrounded by lovely hedgerows. And I'm here to meet Catherine Keena from Chagask, who is going to tell us all about Chagask's Hedgerow Week, which is starting on Monday, the 7th of December. How are you, Catherine?
Lovely to see you, Hannah.
Hedgerow Week. Chagask always have a Hedgerow Week, but this year, it's like everything else, it's Hedgerow Week with a difference. So tell us all about it. What's planned?
Well, because we can't have our normal range of events, we've gone virtual like everybody else. So it's given me a fantastic opportunity to gather together with experts that I might normally get to pull into an event to get video clips and articles on every angle I could think of about hedges. So we're talking of things from the biodiversity point of view. We're talking of the birds, bats, bees, the plants that are in hedges. So I went and I talked to an expert on each topic. So we will be launching through the normal social media, and it will be on our website, 2-minute video clips on almost 30 topics. We have the food from hedges, we have the other values like carbon, water, heritage, history, and then of course the management of hedges is another large number of topics that we deal with.
Catherine, hedgerows are a complete waste of space. You want to have great big fields to get your great big machinery in. What do you want? Blinking hedgerows taken up half. I mean, what is it? 1 acre in 50 was taken up with hedgerows. That's an awful waste of land that you could be growing crops on. How do you sell this to farmers who may, in fact, think like that?
Yes, and that was the thinking. I think we're in the space now where the environment is more important. I mean, I've been working at this, as you know, Anna, for 25 years or more. And in the last year, I think I have seen a real shift, especially in mainstream agriculture. I suppose we're very conscious of our green image. We have reports all the time coming out about the decline in biodiversity. So we're ready for more hedges.
Yes, indeed, because in fact, I was just saying this to you as the devil's advocate. If you're a stock farmer, which we're not on a stock farm today, but if you're on a farm with animals, the hedgerows are hugely important physically as a shelter. I mean, you can't really cuddle up to an electric fence if the wind is blowing sideways and the rain is coming down like I don't know what. Whereas the cattle, you often see them cuddled up to the side of the hedge as protection. And of course, if you're a tillage farmer like we are here, in your hedgerows and on your field margins, you're going to have the pollinators for their bean crops. You're going to have the birds to eat the aphids off their crops. So purely from a point of view of making their farms better, the hedgerows pay back the land they take by contributing to the actual economic results of the farm. Would you think that's the case?
Well, I'm delighted you brought up the point that they have disadvantages too, in that they take up land space. So we don't want to ignore that issue. It's probably far easier to farm with one huge big grassland field even. But while farmers do like the shelter, they do take up space. But I think we now really want our farms to be both producing food and biodiversity and the other ecosystem services for stock management and shelter, etc.
You mentioned those terrible words, ecosystem services. In other words, if the wildlife and if the habitats can't justify themselves on an economic basis, then we should doubt it. But in actual fact, hedgerows have economic services, and one you wouldn't think of, which is water management. Now, how can a couple of trees and shkaks and a bush in the side of your field, how can that affect the water levels in a positive way? Because it does. Would you like to expand on that for us, Catherine?
Certainly, and one of the interviews we have is with our ASAP advisor explaining how hedgerows in the landscape control the flow of water and block sediment and the nutrients that it carries with it. So a hedge landscape has been shown through research to have better water quality. It also helps to regulate flooding.
So, when I come from County Louth, we all know I come from County Louth, and up in County Louth, we used to call them gripes. Go out and throw that in the gripe, my mother would say, when they'd be throwing out the old leaves or the tea leaves, because we had a sort of a compost heap there. But then, if you went to County Monaghan, everything was referred to as a shuck. This was in the shuck, and that was in the shuck, and the shuck was the thing that was, it was that. Then you can call it a hedge. You can call it a hedgerow, you can call it a ditch. There's all sorts of names for them. And of course, the different things that grow in them, shkaks and bushes and things like this. So grikes even is another word for them. Yeah. So Catherine, you're from Offaly. What do you call them down there?
Ditches, Anna, is what I find most through the country. Ditches or hedges. And the shuck or the gripe would usually be the drain. So, but yeah, the hedges or ditches would be the main thing, cutting the ditches.
You didn't mention the double ditch. Now, that was a real remark in where we came from. If you really wanted to insult somebody, you said you're as thick as a double ditch. And the double ditch actually was the boundary of the Pale. If you remember, the Pale was the bit where the English lived, and then you had the terrible Irish outside the Pale, and just expressions beyond the Pale. But the Pale was actually a double ditch, where you had a line of trees, a ditch in between, like a gripe, a hollow, a shkak, and then you had another line of trees. So you had a line of trees, sort of a rivery thing in between, and then another line in the trees. And that was a double ditch, and it was a boundary between the Pale and the terrible Irish. And there still remains of that particular double ditch still to be seen in County Kildare. So they were parish boundaries, some of them were. They were field boundaries, some of them were more... bigger and longer there than others. Remember, as a kid going through the fields at home, when he went between Stavannon and Rootstown, the hedge was different. You couldn't get through it. I don't know if they used to lay the hedge or something. We could get through all the other hedges, but we couldn't get through that one. So they have different functions. Apart from marking out the actual fields themselves, they can actually mark out townlands and pale, even if that's what you're marking out. Very important things. And they go back a long time, some of them do too.
History there is what you're describing are the really old ones and even more valuable. So they go back thousands of years. And then most of our hedgerows were only planted 100 to 200 years ago, kind of up to the famine in the couple of years where there was laws encouraging farmers to plant hedges. So most of our hedges have only been here about 200 years.
Catherine, can you give me a profile of your ideal hedge and your ideal hedge management? So you are looking now at the perfect hedge. What is its shape? How should you trim it, manage it? Give us chapter and verse on how to manage a hedge.
Well, Anna, I have two types of hedges to tell you about. Simplifying the wide variety of hedges that are out there. But they basically fall into two groups. One which are topped and the others which are not topped. So let's deal with the topped ones first. So we side trim that from a wide base to a triangular profile, leaving the height as high as possible, but at least 1.5 metres for birds to nest in. So we top it, but we leave occasional trees, including thorns, to grow up as individuals. And they then have buckets of flowers and fruit for the birds and bees. So that's our topped hedge. And what we don't want there is the short back and sides. And the second type of hedge then is the one that has never been topped. It's really a line of trees, but I still call it a hedgerow. And that is fantastic for wildlife as well. And the management for that is to side trim only. And the very wrong thing to do there is to top it at kind of 4 or 5 foot high, because that pulls all the growth up to that level. It's neither a hedge nor a tree. So you end up with stalks and a little bushy top like a toilet brush hedge.
So a lot of work is done by people who are just hedge contractors. That's their job. And there's a lot of criticism about the way they actually cut the hedges. Is this all justified, or is there some cases where they do flail the hedges and leave them exposed and raw and open?
Yeah, it's a really important point, what's going on here. Because even in my research, I found that the farmers think the contractors know best. The contractors think they know what the farmer wants, and they both think they're doing what the neighbours looking in want. So there's a circle here that needs to be broken with education and with everybody talking to each other. And contractors are paid to do a job. They will do anything you ask them to do because they're being paid. So we in Chagask are encouraging farmers to engage with contractors to have the conversation before the hedges are cut by the contractor.
We also have here Pat Rooney, whose farm it is. Pat, you've a great farm and plenty of hedgerows. What kind of farming have you got here?
Well, we're mainly tillage farmers. We grow a lot of corn, wheat and barley, and some orchard rape and beans. I'm involved here with 2 sons. My father bought this farm back in 1950, so it's a long time, second generation and third generation coming on.
Your father came here in the 1950s, you said, bought the farm, a big farm. Was there more hedges there then than there are now? Did he take hedges out, or did you put them back? Or what's the story? Tell us the truth.
No, the fields are bigger, and we did take some hedgerows and some ditches out. We have planted a few acres of forestry as well to make up for that a bit, which should compensate in the long term as well.
As Pat was saying there, removing the hedgerows and replacing them in some instances with little pockets of trees will actually, if you were to do percentages, one makes up for the other. Is this happening in other places besides here with Pat, Catherine?
Again, I think farmers love trees, and native woodland is fabulous on every farm. I think it's worth pointing out the hedges. The huge benefit they have over even woodland is their linear feature, acting as corridors of movement for the birds, bats and bees that go out. So an acre of woodland spread out as hedges would be far more valuable.
a subject dear to my own heart, food from the hedges. You were out with Paul Flynn collecting food. I mean, everybody knows about blackberries, but what else can you eat from a hedge?
Yes, and we had Rosemary Cusack with us, who had cooked up lots of treats for us on the day. The rose hip cordial, she had made blackberry muffins, I suppose the sloe gin. So Paul Flynn and Rosemary discussed all the wonderful things you can do with the food from we foraged from the hedges.
Chagas Hedgerow Week has been launched now by Minister Pippa Hackett, and it's going to run from Monday the 7th of December. What are the events that you have lined up for our delectation?
So each day that week, there will be a number of two-minute video clips and related articles published through social media and on our website, chagas.ie. On Friday the 4th, when Minister Hackett is launching the week, there's a webinar there, and again, as a part of our signpost series at 9:30 on Friday the 4th, when all the information will be provided. And everyone can find out more on chagas.ie.
So it was great to be here, meeting yourself, Catherine, and meeting Pat, and in this lovely farm with the sun shining and the cars coming in and out and the busyness of it all. Thank you very much, Catherine.
Thanks a million, Aina.
Thank you, Aina. More details on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, Seal Rescue Ireland have been in touch with us. Seal Rescue Ireland is a charity dedicated to the rescue, rehabilitation and release of seals around the coast of Ireland. They've teamed up with a software company called Salesforce to plant 20,000 native trees to help protect wildlife and address the negative impacts of climate change. Our own John Bellarotti asked SRI Executive Director Melanie Crosey to make the link between tree planting and protecting Ireland's wild seals.
So Seal Rescue Ireland is dedicated to the rescue, rehab and release of sick, injured and orphan seals from all across Ireland. But what we've learned is the best way to protect wild seals is to protect the world around us. And planting trees not only fights climate change by sequestering carbon, but it's also providing habitat for biodiversity. And if properly planted along waterways, it protects rivers and streams from pollution and sediment runoff that would otherwise pollute the marine environment. So in that way, we can actually protect the marine environment, promote marine biodiversity, and provide a safer and healthier environment for our seals to thrive. And as we do it, we're actually protecting all wildlife as well as the well-being of each other.
So you say, Melanie, that the native trees will be planted along our shorelines and our waterways. Can you just expand a little on how that'll protect the adjacent marine environment?
So trees and vegetation that are planted along waterways are called riparian buffers, and it basically acts like a filter that filters out sediments and pollutants from making their way into our waters. And that keeps our rivers, streams, and coastal waters a lot clearer and healthier. It promotes seagrass beds and kelp forests, which further grow and sequester carbon fighting climate change. They also provide fish habitat for nurseries for growing fish. So it's great for the marine biodiversity. And of course, that's beneficial for seals that eat fish as well as ourselves.
So it sounds very much, Melanie, like a holistic approach. Has this model been tried anywhere else?
It is absolutely a holistic approach. It's basically the best way to maximize the impact of planting trees is putting the proper trees in the proper locations. It has been tried in other places. In the United States, they plant riparian buffers, and also in New Zealand and entire bay and harbor ecosystems, the fisheries have come back just due to planting native trees along waterways. So Ireland used to have over 80% of deciduous forests covering it, and now we only have less than 2%. So there's a huge opportunity to recover Ireland's native forests and clean up our waterways while we do it.
And just broadening it out a little, can you give us a sense as to how Ireland's wild seal population has been impacted by climate change?
As the severity and frequency of storms increase, it makes it much more difficult for seals to survive. They're getting tossed around in storms, they can drown, they can get injured, and young pups get separated from their mothers. So climate change is impacting our seals because of all of these storms. So if we're planting trees and fighting climate change, then we're working towards a future where seals will be safe and healthy in their environment.
Melanie Crosey, Executive Director of Seal Rescue Ireland, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
And that's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarnath Holland. We had Dr. Richard Collins in Malahide, Niall Hatch in Kilcool, and Aini Lana was in Old Town in North County, Dublin. We'll do it all again next week. Until then, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.